Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Welcome, and thank you very much for joining us today. I recently had the great pleasure of talking with Timothy Morton about his new book, Hyperobjects: Philosophy and Ecology After the End of the World. This was published in 2013 with the University of Minnesota Press. Now, what is philosophy and ecology after the end of the world? The whole book is devoted to exploring this, explicating this, and it does so by taking as its focus this notion of hyperobjects. Now, what hyperobjects are, what their qualities are, how to understand them, and how to think with them is, in fact, the whole point of the narrative and the argument of the book, so I won't go into too much detail about that right now. But I will say that in taking on a kind of object like global warming, something that is so huge that we can't ever see it in its entirety or experience it in its entirety at any given moment, what Morton does is he really opens up a whole way of thinking with and thinking about objects in the world. It's really been transformative for me since reading the book and talking with him about it, in the way I think about not just things and objects, but also how I see artworks, how I listen to music. And you'll hear toward the end of our conversation that a lot of the book, especially the last part of the book, is really devoted to introducing and asking us to think about some artistic representations and explorations of some of the ideas that either he's talking about or some ideas that engage with and intersect with the ideas that he's talking about. So it's a really fascinating book. I think it's a really important book, and it's very useful, especially in the context of this channel, for those of us who think about and think with STS. So objects in terms of actor network theory, in terms of networks. This will really, if you take this book and its contents to heart, and its arguments to heart, it'll really potentially change how you think about what an object is, how it functions as part of a network, and how we do STS, frankly. So I think it's a really fascinating book. It's really fun to read. It's written in a really engaging style. And Tim is very fun and very engaging to talk with about it. And so I hope you enjoy the book. I hope you get as much out of it as I did. And I hope you really enjoy the conversation. I'm here today with Timothy Morton to talk about his new book, Hyperobjects: Philosophy and Ecology After the End of the World. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, Tim. Thank you for your patience in dealing with the inevitable technological complications of having these kinds of remote conversations. And thank you for taking time to talk with me, as we've already been talking about, even though listeners won't be privy to the previous incarnation of this. It's an absolutely fabulous book. I really, really loved it, and I'm really, really grateful that you're willing to take the time.
Oh, gosh.
So thank you.
That's very nice of you, Carla. And yeah, given that we are inside, one of the hyperobjects that we're inside is Earth's magnetic field.
That's right.
These things can happen.
That's right. So, Tim, could you start us off again by saying a little bit about yourself and your background, and specifically, how did you come to this particular combination of work that bring, or the particular kind of work that brings together the combination of a very philosophically informed approach to problems that engage ecology and ecological thought?
Yeah, right on. I've written obliquely about ecology since 1989, when I did my first stuff at Oxford on food, you know, because when you write about food, it's always, you had to think about ecology. But there was this rather conservative with a small c kind of environment around talking about ecology in the humanities at the time. And so it took me a rather long time to get my mojo together to address it explicitly. And so the first book that was really explicitly about ecology was Ecology Without Nature, which, you know, the conclusion is in the title, right? If you want to think in an ecological way, paradoxically, you have to drop the concept of nature. And then I wrote what I take to be the prequel to that, which is called The Ecological Thought. And, you know, it was very nice to write that book. It was a way of exploring Darwin and related evolution theory and some of the philosophical things that I'm still interested in, such as deconstruction. And in that book, I developed this concept of hyperobjects. And it was towards the end, you know, and I sort of looked at the word and I thought, oh, yeah, that sounds interesting. These huge, great things, like not just one styrofoam cup, but all the styrofoam cups on Earth ever, right? Not just one shower of rain, but all the climate on Earth ever, right? Not just this telephone conversation, but all the electromagnetic waves, right, on Earth, right, or around Earth, right, and so on and so on and so on. Pollution, radiation, you know, all these things like that, right? They aren't just concepts, they're things, right? They're like aggregates of, you know, bursts of gamma rays, right, scaled up to a massive spatiotemporal scale. And so I called them hyperobjects, and I thought, oh, that's an interesting word. I wonder what it means. It's like a sort of 16x9 letterbox widescreen word, you know, and it's got this weird fusion of Greek and Latin. And, you know, at the time, I sort of wrote about it a bit in the book, and people picked up on it, and they invited me for some reason. For a whole year, I got flown around Earth. People were saying, can you stand in front of our small group of academics and say the word hyperobjects with some kind of explanation as to this peculiar word? And so I did that for a bit, and out of that came the book, and that was why it was so nice to write it, because I sort of gigged it before I wrote it, you know. And so I sat down in the cafeteria of my university at the time and just wrote it without any notes in 15 days, and then gradually put all the footnotes in and all that, and just that's how the book showed up. And I think it is a book. I think it really is a book rather than like a talk or an essay or something.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that's really striking as a reader is how organically it works as a book, and how well designed and thoughtfully designed it is as a book. And I'll just mention, I see a lot of books. I read a lot of books because, you know, for various reasons, because of a particular way of being an academic that I've somehow adopted. And it's such a pleasure, and it's so relatively rare to have an object like this that's clearly, that springs from organically and very thoughtfully the kind of topics and the kind of issues that you're writing about. So the book is split into two parts, right? And we can talk about this, and I'll ask you to say a little bit more about this. Part one offers a kind of philosophical, historical, cultural explication and explanation of hyperobjects, of what they are, what their qualities are. And then part two, as you put it, explores the human appropriation of hyperobjects. It's not separated formally into numbered chapters. It's quite a bit more thoughtful than that, actually. And so could you say a little bit about the structure of the book, how you designed it, and how you came to really building it in this particular way?
Yeah. After a certain while, once you've done a few of these things called books, you realize something that's blindingly obvious about them to everybody except for you, because you're an intellectual. Not you, Carla, but me, right? Idiot me. After about doing four of them, I realized, oh yeah, duh, a book, whether you like it or not, is a product that somebody buys in a store, right? This buyer is in Amazon, and she's thinking, oh, that looks like something I want to part with my hard-earned cash for the sake of reading. Who is that, and why does she want to read it, right? Mm-hmm. And so a book has to be something that sort of surprises you somehow, or takes you on some kind of journey, so that you end up in a place where you weren't when you read it. When you come out of the pipe of the book, something about the way you think about things has been slightly transformed, yeah? And so that's why you're willing to pay cash money, you know, because that's what you want, yeah? And what I wanted was for that person to be almost anybody, right? Like, not just a scholar. So my first thought was, let's write it in a way that is really easy to read, but really difficult to understand, but you can read it, right? So you're delivering the concepts in a way that's totally easy to understand the sentences, right? But obviously it's very difficult to think them, right? And you're trying to empower people to think those things. And so when I put it through a readability test, it came out as ever so slightly easier to read than T.H. White, The Sword in the Stone. And that was good for me, because that meant that technically, like, someone who was 12 could read it, they wouldn't understand it. Even I don't understand it, for goodness sake, you know. But somehow they could at least read it, right? And then, you know, more sort of specifically, you start to think, if you've done a few of these things, a book doesn't have to just be a certain number of chapters, right? A book could be all kinds of different things. And I was in Toyota getting my car fixed, and I thought, what's this book? This is a stupid enough place to start this book. Let's do it. Oh, right. It's really two parts. It's not chapters, because basically it's just basically like, what are hyperobjects? And how should we humans kind of dispose ourselves towards them? So it's a book with numbered sections, with titles, right? Subsections. I thought, oh, that's brilliant. That works. And when you give yourself a constraint, when you're doing a long-term project, it's really good and sort of necessary. And so that was one reason why it then became quite easy to actually put it together. So yeah, the structure of it, but also I think the sort of the tone, you know, which is a little bit maybe personal is a word, or maybe phenomenological is a word, or sort of experiential or something, because first of all, it does help you to go on that journey. And second of all, I truly believe that one of the mistakes that the intellectuals have made for about 200 years, funnily enough, since the beginning of the what we'll talk about in a bit, the Anthropocene, which is the big Mac Daddy hyperobject, kind of dominant way of being a humanist and intellectual is to talk about the possibility for talking about in this kind of infinite Monty Python argument sketch, the regress, right? And for technical reasons, which I'll be happy to explain if you want, that's impossible. And so you might as well, instead of doing that, which I associate with a kind of cynical reason, where I'm proving that I'm cleverer than you because I can see through you from my lofty position, you dive into the other thing, which is the hypocrisy thing, you know? And so you have to be like just this idiot who vaguely notices these things happening in the world, like global warming.
Well,
in the style.
I think one of the really wonderful things about the style as well, and I think you mentioned this early on in the book, is that it does reproduce the kind of relationship that we have to hyperobjects in terms of knowability by giving us glimpses and not necessarily writing this book in such a way that you're assuming through the structure that it's possible to give a complete and perfect, unproblematic, understandable from the first go image of what hyperobjects and their consequences are, because that would in fact undermine the kind of work that you're doing, right? So I mentioned earlier, and I'll mention again, it really does resemble one of my favorite images in the book that's there from the beginning, which is this octopus. So you mention or you describe all entities as shy and retiring octopuses that squirt out a dissembling ink as they withdraw into the ontological shadows. And so just as the octopus recurs throughout the chapters, also the voice of describing and taking us into a relationship with the phenomena that you're talking about also kind of comes to the surface and sinks down and offers us glimpses into the shadows and then sheds light on them and then makes us realize the futility of trying to see everything all at once and grasp it, because that's just not the way it works, right? And I think the way that you are taking a very intimate tone in writing the book and the way that you're structuring the book really does a lot of work to help ground and emphasize and communicate the nature of the arguments that you're making. So
that's very nice of you. And yeah, it was a very deliberate, conscious choice. And, you know, it's to do with this thing that you could call, you know, the phenomenon thing gap, right? I can think global warming, I can compute it, right? But I can't see it, right? That's the trouble. I can see the patches of brown on the lawn outside because it hasn't rained for ages. I can hear radio reports about the flooding in the southwest of England. And all of those things both are and are not global warming at the same time. They're like appearances of global warming. They're global warming phenomena. Mm-hmm. And there's this radical sort of irreducible gap between what a thing is and how it appears. But the real kicker is you can't locate that gap anywhere on the surface or in the depth of the phenomenon that you're sort of studying, right? So it's very disconcerting. And this kind of disconcertingness has been around in philosophy since Kant, you know, who at the start of this Anthropocene thing pointed out this phenomenon thing gap. And it's sort of how science works, right? We have all this data, and then you see patterns in the data, and then you infer various correlations that may or may not result in a conclusion that there's some causal relationship. But you can't see back directly the cause and effect stuff churning away underneath. In fact, you come to realize that that is a really out-of-date picture, and that funnily enough, the octopus ink, which is the phenomena, the data that's coming out of the octopus, sort of is where the causality is, weirdly. So imagine if the octopus was really articulate and was able to go on the Oprah Winfrey show, right? And for some reason it was like some kind of Muppet octopus that could speak English. And what this octopus said about herself, right, would be very, very, you know, well articulated, because she's been in psychoanalysis for a long time. And yet, what she says on the Oprah show is not her, it's not the octopus, it's actually lots of stuff that she said, right? So we have this weird situation where this octopus is an octopus, right? It's not a toaster, right? It's this discrete, unique thing. It's not just a lump of blah. It's an actual octopus, right? And yet, we can't point out what the actual fundamental octopus is, apart from all these octopus appearances, like having eight legs and suckers and, you know, being at this step in the evolutionary history of life forms on Earth and all that kind of stuff, and experiencing all kinds of emotions and hugging you in this funny way and all that with their tentacles. You know, all of those things aren't octopuses. They're octopus appearances, but they're inseparably glued to what an octopus actually is. So we have this weird paradox, right? There is global warming, but you can't directly see it or touch it. So the trouble is, the deniers can get in there and say, look, see, it doesn't exist because you can't see it or touch it. Like, it snowed in Boise, Idaho last week, so it can't exist, you know. And in a way, that's another kind of way of covering over this phenomenon thing gap. They're basically saying that if I can't see it or touch it, it's not real. And that's a kind of pre-Kantian thought. It's like Dr. Johnson, you know, saying, I refute him thus, sir, by kicking a stone on a beach. You know, when you kick a stone on a beach to refute an argument, you haven't made a refutation. What you've done, he's refuting Berkeley, actually, what you've done is you've made a kicking sound. And this kicking sound is not an argument. It's just a kind of brutal, aggressive noise that you use in some kind of macho way to perform, you know, I don't want to know anything about this thing that I can't see or touch but's real, right? And that's the thing about these hyper objects. They are totally real, right? But you can't see or touch them. And then, with 2020 hindsight, based on getting used to these things, like since the 19th century, yeah, deep ecological time, evolution, climate, things like El Nino, you know, which were discovered in the later 19th century, and on and on and on and on, radiation, electromagnetism, on and on and on and on, right? You basically get to this point where you realize that things like bottle caps and iPhones and tables are also like that.
That's right. And so this actually brings us really nicely into what I wanted to ask you about next. We've been talking about hyperobjects, and in fact, the book is about hyperobjects as ostensibly the special category of kinds of things. And the first part of the book is going to take us through some of those qualities. And we'll talk about some of these in detail. Viscosity, non-locality, temporal undulation, phasing, interobjectivity, and these are all, we'll talk about these in detail and explore what those mean. But by the end of the book, just as some of these qualities are emerged, as you were talking about the octopus on Oprah, right? By the end of the book, we realize that perhaps all objects, including the octopus on Oprah, are hyperobjects. Now, you mentioned just a few minutes ago The Big Mac Daddy hyperobject, that is the Anthropocene. And this is, in fact, a way of grounding how you are contextualizing this study and also putting it into dialogue with some recent works of anthropology, of philosophy, that are also situating different ways of studying and understanding selves in the world in the context of a proposition of this periodizing of the world and our place in it through the notion of the Anthropocene. So could you talk a little bit about that? What is the Anthropocene for you, and what kind of work is it doing for the kinds of arguments that you're making here in the book?
Sure. So the Anthropocene is a term for a geological period. And it's a very weird geological period because it's a geological period that, unlike other geological periods, or at least most of them, is defined by a catastrophe. That's actually a very good way of defining geological periods. I think it's better than the kind of linear progression of them. That's always a bit paradoxical. But anyway, we can talk about that if we like. But the other strange thing about it is that you can almost date the beginning of it, or at least one of the decisive beginnings of it, to 1784. That's really weird, you know, to date a geological period to a certain time in human history. But it's the moment at which the steam engine was invented. Now, Karl Marx says that when the steam engine was patented as this general machine that you could plug into all these other machines, you've basically got industrial capitalism. And it was created to, you know, solve problems relating to feeding more people more of the time in the later 18th century. So it's the agricultural revolution morphing into the industrial revolution. And then Paul Crutzen, who's an atmospheric chemist, also dates the beginning of the Anthropocene to this invention of the steam engine, because it's then that you start doing things like shoveling enormous amounts of coal into steam engines to make them work, and then later on you start turning ignition in your car and putting oil and gas in it to make it go, right? And these things have resulted in a layer of carbon in Earth's crust, among other things, that is decisively made by humans. And I'm sticking with that. Humans made the Anthropocene, not octopuses, not toasters, not jellyfish or coral reefs. It was humans. And if that makes me an anthropocentrist, then so be it. But I don't think it does, actually. I think what it does is it makes me realize that I am a member of a hyperobject. I'm a phenomenon of a thing called human race, let's say, provocatively, that I can't directly see or touch. There's a word for people who think they can see or touch what human species is. It's called racist, right? That's another way of filling in this kind of phenomenon thing gap with some kind of weird putty that's going to stop you from seeing the gap. So you say, oh, humans are this and humans are that, right? It's racism and speciesism. I think this Anthropocene concept is the first truly, genuinely anti-anthropocentric concept, because what it actually means is not big bad humans now control reality because we're Harold and the purple crayon and we can do anything. Let's geoengineer the heck out of Earth. I think that's not what it's saying. I think what it's saying is, as in the words of the great, you know, philosopher Buckaroo Banzai, wherever you go, there you are, right? In other words, you think you're so special, Mr. Humanoid, you know, but really everything you do is totally caught in a very specific web of fate, which is basically Earth conditions, Earth systems, other life forms, and your needs and drives and wishes and unconscious fantasies and blah, 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 and concepts and ideas and all that stuff, right? And, you know, you're not this master, actually, of the universe, and you're not, you haven't achieved escape velocity from your conditions, which was, of course, the fantasy that they were all having in the later 18th century and that we still have, right? You know, it's a very common move. Which I was just talking about, you know, this kind of meta, meta, meta. Anything you can do, I can do, meta. It's this thing where you go, I am now talking to you from a position outside of human philosophy, outside of social history, something, 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 philosophy, blah, 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 right? And it's this weird kind of gesture that's actually impossible. It's a little bit like John Cleese arrests, no, he doesn't arrest, silly me, getting too excited. John Cleese sues people who treat him like Basil Fawlty. Now, that should strike you as was ironic, because that's the kind of thing that Basil Fawlty would do, right? Basil Fawlty would sue people who sort of imitate his funny walk and all that stuff and get him to do the voice and Sybil, Sybil, and all that, right? But, and so the very act of him sort of trying to achieve escape velocity from being Basil Fawlty is precisely what's Basil Fawlty about him, right? So the very act of us trying to sort of escape from our social and historical conditions and from the entanglements in material things and the web of fate as we now construe it in modernity is just drilling down, literally in this case, because it's about oil, deeper into that web of fate. And it's basically the structure of any Greek tragedy. You know, the tragic hero discovers that she or he, in his or her very attempt to escape, has actually made it worse, right? Look at the Oedipus story, right? And it's also the structure of my favorite kind of movie, which is the film noir, right? Which basically has the form of romantic irony, where, you know, the detective discovers that he or she is the culprit. Right, Angel Heart, Blade Runner, right, Deckard discovers that he's a replicant, right? It's the same when you realize that you're a member of the human species. It's this thing that isn't you, but it's actually much more you than you are. You're just a phenomenon of it.
This is actually a really beautiful way of also getting at one or two of the fundamental points that emerge out of the book, right? And so I think this lack of an outside, this inability to get outside of the phenomena really sounds a lot like this point about the end of the world that you're making.
Oh, yeah.
And it gets us, I think, really nicely into a discussion of some of the qualities of hyperobjects. And so just as there is no drilling down to get beyond, right, to get outside, you're making the point in the second part of the book, but this is something that infuses every part of the book at the same time, that hyperobjects are responsible for the end of the world. There's a very particular way that you're invoking that. And so one of the implications of that, and I'll ask you to talk about that, what does that mean, the end of the world, is that there is no getting away from, there is no away. And this brings us to also one of the first qualities of hyperobjects, which is they stick to beings that are involved with them. So we have this collection or constellation right now of hyperobjects stick to beings that are involved with them. This is what you call viscosity. And this is a way of understanding how and why there is no getting away from, which means there are no boundaries to the world that's somehow this container outside of us, which means we're at the end of the world, which actually creates some possibilities rather than closing them off. So could you talk, there's a lot going on here, but can you talk about this? Viscosity, the absence of getting away, and the end of the world.
Yeah, maybe I can start with the end of the world. Haha.
Perfect.
Because it is in the subtitle of the book, right?
Yes.
And the idea is it started off as a kind of general gripe that I had, that I was talking about in talks and writing about in other stuff, about this idea that the end of the world is coming and we have to do something to stop it, right? Which is actually structurally remarkably similar to what George Bush thinks. You know, there's an apocalypse coming and we have to do something, or rather in his case, we have to not do anything, right, about Earth conditions, because the apocalypse will wipe us all out. And so there's like left wing and right wing and kind of sophisticated speculative realist and all kinds of nihilist ways of thinking about that end of the world thing. And I think this thing is kind of blocking us from actually relating to ourselves and other non-humans, you know, in a way that has a little bit of ecological justice, ethics, mercy, whatever you want to call that, politics, right, in it. Funnily enough, it's very inhibiting, right? And obviously the rhetoric of it hasn't been working. If I get another email that says Earth is about to blow up, you know, with global warming, I'm going to scream. You know, it doesn't work. It immediately pushes, especially a conservative denier person, into defiance. And you don't want to do that. I think just strategically, we'll get to the more kind of philosophical reason in a minute. I just think strategically it's better to start with, we are already dead. The disaster has already occurred. This is the afterlife. You're actually, you know, like in that movie, Jacob's Ladder, the guy has to figure out that he's already dead. Then he can act, right? But before he figures that out, he's like in complete confusion and horror. You know, it's some great relief realizing, oh, it already happened, right? It happened in 1790s, you know, beginning with the shoveling of coal into these steam engine things, and it carried on with Nagasaki and Hiroshima and the dropping of the bomb, which also put another layer of things in Earth's crust and blah, blah, blah. And this is after the end of the world, right? But it's not just that. It's like when you scale up human actions or any actions to Earth magnitude, there's no such thing as a way, right? So when you flush the toilet, yeah, whatever is in there doesn't go away when you look at it in Earth magnitude. It just goes into, you know, the Gulf or the Atlantic or the wastewater treatment plant, right? And so since there's no away, there's really no world, because the idea of world is I'm surrounded by things that are within a kind of horizon, and beyond that horizon is something that I can't quite know, right? But I do know it now. I do know explicitly where my toilet waste goes, right? It's part of the reason why people resist thinking ecologically, because it's so, they think it's boring, but what's underneath the boringness is actually a feeling of abjection, right? Like, I'm surrounded by waste stuff from me and other beings, and I am kind of waste stuff from me and other beings. And, you know, it's just like, I'm surrounded and penetrated and made up of all these things that aren't me, and I can't peel them off me, right? So that's sort of like viscosity, right? Now, the other thing about viscosity is it's a little bit like realizing that you're in a loop, right? It's a little bit like realizing that no matter what you do to try to escape from the loop, you make the loop worse, right? And that's basically ecological awareness. And I think ecological awareness takes this kind of loop form where you think that you're doing something on one level, but actually on another level, you're doing something totally different. And those two levels are actually completely mixed together, but you can't tell. It's like being on a Möbius strip, right? Like a strip of two-dimensional stuff that's been twisted and made into a loop. And when you draw your finger around it, you think you're just drawing your finger around it, but suddenly you realize you flip over onto the other side. But then you think, when did that flip happen? The twist was everywhere in the strip. So really, there's no other side, right? There's no world, because world also depends on this idea of there's another side, right? Somewhere over there, there's this thing called nature or beyond or, you know, over there, right? And when you think about ecological stuff, where does that stop, right? Does it stop at on, you know, Earth's atmosphere, or does it stop with the magnetic shield around Earth that protects life forms from being zapped, or does it therefore actually stop with the sun or the solar system? I mean, it just goes on, right? It's, you can't actually draw a boundary that well, yeah? And so from my point of view, philosophy had better stop getting into the boundary drawing business, right? It's better get out of that business of trying to establish what the difference is between a phenomenon and a thing, and instead it should get into the allergy medicine business. We need thinking that enables us to have not so much of an allergic reaction to other beings, so that we don't automatically delete them in some way, quite literally or conceptually, you know, and instead are able to tolerate coexisting with them, just like you tolerate coexisting with like hay fever pollen when you take the allergy medicine. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you're sort of surrounded by it and penetrated. It's like the Force, but only like really sucky, and it makes you feel bad, you know, and it's really physical, you know. And so viscosity is like that. It's like the more you try to pull away, the more you find yourself stuck. So, of course, one solution to global warming is, oh, I know, I've got a clever idea. Let's fill the ocean with copper or iron or whatever the hell. Let's make a huge mirror and put it in space, you know. And even James Lovelock says, you know, please trust us, engineer, scientist, people. We know we've been Mr. Hyde for 200 years, but really, we can be Dr. Jekyll. Really, seriously, trust us, give us your money. Trust us, please. And it's like, really, are you seriously comparing yourself to Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? Because that's the least trustworthy thing I can possibly think of, you know. That makes me want to run very fast, right? And so one of the things is, let's try not doing that for a bit. I mean, how's that been working out, right? This idea that we can totally manipulate and change everything, you know. And I know that's the sort of fear that people have about this Anthropocene thing. They think, oh, it's the ultimate sort of we're all George Bush decider type people who just decide and create realities and oppress other life forms and stuff. But it's not. It's almost the opposite. It's like, do you realize that when you're doing that, you're actually imprisoning yourself much worse in the phenomena you're trying to escape?
Mm-hmm. And actually, this also kind of, for me, evokes one of the other qualities of hyperobjects that you talk about here in this part of the book, which is interobjectivity. And you make the point here that entities are all connected into an interobjective system you call the mesh, and talk about that as a fundamental property of these objects. And so this seems to be, I think, a really nice evocation of that. Also, now, because of the allergy metaphor, I am not going to be able to think about viscosity anymore without thinking about blowing my nose, which is not entirely but again, also in the spirit of this connectivity that so beautifully comes out in the book and so beautifully comes out in how you're describing the book, I think you also talked about the Mobius strip, which brings us to another one of the characteristics of hyperobjects, which is the way that they problematize notions of locality.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as a historian reading this book, and albeit a very freakish kind of transdisciplinary sort of historian, one of the preoccupations that I have as just part of my craft is a way of trying to think through and think about time and space creatively and as part of the craft of what it is to tell a story, the creation of time and space. And so this part of the book in which you're talking about the ways that hyperobjectivity really challenges the way we might otherwise take for granted ways of thinking about time and space is really, really productive. And I think, other things, among many other things in the book, is one of the really important aspects of this potentially with wide implications for those of us who work on anything having to do with time and space, which is all of us, right? But historians in particular.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about time and space here. A couple of the qualities, in addition to this viscosity that we talked about and the interobjectivity, two of the other qualities that hyperobjects manifest are what you call non-locality. So hyperobjects are non-local, and also temporal undulation. They involve very different temporalities. In fact, they create different temporalities than those that we're typically familiar with on a human scale. So can you talk about these elements of our knowledge of and understanding of hyperobjects, time and space, and how they kind of mess with our notions thereof?
Oh, sure. So we may all be familiar with the sort of weird thing that happens to very, very small things, which is that you can entangle them such that you can make one, you know, polarize or jiggle in a certain way, and then the other entangled particle does exactly the sort of complementary thing, not exactly the same. Instantly, in other words, like as if the speed of light could be broken, right? And that's a bit weird. And so people are thinking, what is that? And some people are thinking, is this just a funny thing that happens at the quantum level, or actually could it happen at higher levels? And some of the younger physicists are starting to seriously take that concept for a bit more of a spin. It was considered quite taboo when it first started off. And some of the early physicists got into big trouble for thinking about it. But now it's quite clear that you can also entangle, you know, things that are millions and millions of times larger than, you know, subatomic particles like electrons or photons. Yeah. So that provides a kind of metaphor for thinking about how, you know, we're having this phone conversation, right? And you're, I don't know what, 2,000 miles away, maybe more. And yet I'm talking to you, and somehow we are linked through the magnetic shield around Earth via this telephone, and so on and so on. And so there's a way in which distance is weirdly abolished. That's not quite the same as non-locality, because, you know, then, you know, there's still some time involved, right? But it's kind of an interesting metaphor, and it might not even be a metaphor. You know, it might just be the case that everything really does behave in a quantum way. It's just that we haven't gotten the ability to, you know, do more to larger things, because you have to make them very, very cold and very, 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 very still and in a vacuum before you can actually observe these things. And it's really difficult to do that with something the size of me without causing me to die and other things like that. And so that sort of non-locality, and, you know, you think about how the weather over there can influence the weather over here. That's because the weather over there and the weather over here are inside this higher dimensional thing called climate, right? And so the weather over there is a local manifestation of the climate, you know, of Earth climate, and the weather over here is a manifestation of it. And so those two things are interlinked in some way, although they appear to be different, right? So sort of it's a metaphor, but it's maybe more than a metaphor, right? And the whole idea that, you know, when you talk about temporal undulation, what you're talking about is the fact that time and space, if we're really going to get up to speed, finally, at least with Einstein, you have to admit that time and space are aesthetic properties of things. They're not like boxes that contain things. They're actually, or underlie things, they're actually things that sort of ooze out of objects, right? They literally ripple, right? They've just proved that there is really a gravitational field around Earth by putting all these gyroscopes into space, and they actually observed by the movement of these gyroscopes the evidence of the actual gravitational field, right? The gravity well of Earth and space-time vortex, right? That's being emitted by Earth, right? It's actually a thing that comes out of Earth because Earth is a massive object, right? It's a hyper object, right? And so temporality at that scale to do with Earth has weird properties, right, that are different from how I think time goes and space goes, because I'm small enough relative to Earth to feel like I can walk along a kind of nicely linear grid of time, you know. But then, you know, even my watch runs at a different speed when I'm on a plane than it does when I'm down on Earth. So in fact, that idea that I'm actually in a kind of nice, neat grid is just a kind of illusion based on the scale that I'm at. And it's a workable illusion because I can use it to calculate various things like how do I get from A to B, you know, down the street to the supermarket, you know, but it's not completely where it's really at. And so when you think about things that are big enough, you have to think about how they... Time and space are like verbs, you know. Things time and they space, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, and different things have different kinds of space time, and they have different kinds of, as you say, temporality. And it's about time that we just started to really get used to that idea, because I think it's very, very default, intuitive, this kind of easy think kind of time that's just a kind of box.
Now, so if we've talked a little bit about or quite a bit about the background of this idea of hyper objects. We've talked about some of their qualities. So they stick to beings that are involved with them. They exhibit their effect interobjectively. They're non-local and they involve very different temporalities. Now, the last quality that you talk about here is phasing, and it's penultimate in the chapter, but it's maybe get to this last. And this is fascinating. So you've already talked a little bit about what this means, right? In terms of your description of a hyper object as resisting our ability to see the whole thing at the same time. We only see parts. One of the really, really affecting things that came out of this chapter is something that I really love about the whole book, and that is very, very much a characteristic of the age of asymmetry in particular, and we'll get to that. But in this a discussion of phasing as this quality of hyperobjects, you are introducing and bringing us into one of the many, many works of art, of music, of literature, of philosophy that populate the book, and that were just a complete joy for me to learn about for the first time. And so there's just a whole community of new friends, really, that comes out of the book that I'm really delighted to spend time with now that I would not have met had I not read the book. So thank you for that.
Oh, gosh.
So this new friend that came out of this chapter is a painting called Untitled 2011.
Oh, yeah.
Right? By an artist, Yukulji Napangati. And this, use this painting to talk about phasing, but also to talk about much more than that. So could you, if you wouldn't mind, could you introduce this painting for us and talk about its significance? And I should also mention for listeners, there's a really beautiful plate of the painting in the book, so they can go to the book and see it themselves as well.
Oh, brilliant! I'm really glad you asked me that question. So there's this painting, and it's in the Gallery of New South Wales in Sydney. And my friend Douglas Kahn, who is a sound theorist, and I went into this museum because he works in Sydney, and I and him saw this painting. And Yukulji Napangati is one of the Pintupi Nine. She's one of the last people who emerged out of the outback in the early 1980s. And so really her perspective on the world is a little bit sort of Neolithic, indigenous, maybe even pre-Neolithic, Paleolithic, right? Certainly nothing to do with agricultural society, certainly nothing to do with the Anthropocene, right? And what's interesting about it, of course, is that it's deeply, deeply contemporary. And I truly feel like one of the ironic things to do with human beings thinking they've escaped their historical conditions is that through doing this over and over again, we finally achieved a state of awareness that's not unlike being in an indigenous culture. If you think about it, people in indigenous cultures are not happy-go-lucky people immersed in their life world. They're actually really anxious, right? Only they've made friends with their anxiety because they have it all the time. We only have it in our culture when we do things like buy houses or take out student loans, right? But when you have to take out a micro loan, let's say, just to buy a fridge, you know, you've got that anxiety happening all the time. When you don't know when your next meal is coming from, which is a much less contemporary problem, then when, and that's where agriculture was invented, which is the big elephant in the room, by the way. You don't know where your meal is coming from, next meal, right? And so you have basic anxiety. And I think that's very interesting because that's what we've ended up with. By trying to escape from anxiety, we've made it much, much worse, actually. So anyway, this painting is a really beautiful, moving to me painting that it actually does something to you. It's like a sort of, the painting is a painting and it's sort of showing you a little bit in that amazing kind of linear code of Aboriginal painting, the journey of these women across these sand hills, right? And these rituals that they were performing. But it's also this incredible hyper Bridget Riley painting where there are these interlocking force fields of patterns created by the interplay of the wave-like lines on the painting surface, right? And so the painting kind of grips you, you know, it actually sort of holds you and grips you, and it comes all the way to your eyes, just like global warming does and radiation. It comes all the way into you and onto you. It's not just over there, right, in the gallery. It's sort of right in your face, right? And I like that kind of art. I like art that's a little bit threatening to my ego. Anyway, this thing called phasing is what's happening when you're looking at it. Because, like, imagine this thing that we were just talking about, that different objects, space and time in different ways, right, as a verb. So imagine when you chuck a stone into a pond and it makes these ripples, right? And these ripples are space-time ripples, right? Now imagine if you chuck another stone in, there are these other ripples. And where those ripples intersect, there's this thing called an interference pattern, because those two sets of ripples are out of phase with each other. They're happening at different times, at different speeds, across slightly different spaces, right? And the interference pattern can create all kinds of extraordinary effects when you dial it in a certain way. So there's that African sort of moiré pattern that can happen in clothing, for example. So phasing is kind of what happens when we see for very briefly hyper objects, you see, because we only see little pieces of them, right? And those little pieces of them are like out of phase with the whole thing. And so there's this kind of weird interference that happens, right? And it's sort of disturbing and uncanny and, you know, like how an interference pattern is. It's sort of weirdly beautiful, and yet, and at the same time, it sort of defeats your idea that pictures are just static things that exist over there somewhere, because they're sort of shimmering or rippling, and they involve your optic nerve, right? When you get the interference pattern close enough, right, it starts to mess with your optic nerve, so you see all these sort of rainbow patterns happening within the pattern. Right? Or you do if you're me, you know, because you have some kind of weird brain damage, I don't know.
This actually also really beautifully brings us into the last part of the book. So similarly to the way that you're using this painting here to talk about and bring us into not just the phenomenon of phasing as it is a quality of hyperobjects, but also the kind of world that can emerge out of, and aesthetically and experientially thinking with and of and amid this set of phenomena.
Mm.
One of the last chapters of the book really goes into a whole community of these kinds of works that are both beautiful, disturbing, and also engage with the age of what you call asymmetry here. So we've already, in terms of part two of the book, the time of hyperobjects, we've already talked a little bit about the idea of the end of the world. And the last two parts of this part two of the book describe ways that you are arguing here that hyperobjects have ushered in a new human phase of what you call hypocrisy, weakness, and lameness. But hypocrisy, weakness, and lameness also happen to be very generative. I mean, you're really taking these concepts and really complicating them and turning them around. There's a whole section on hypocrisies. The age of asymmetry actually goes into the other sort of some works that engage these other two qualities. So could you, in whatever way that excites you, talk about these notions of hypocrisy, weakness, and/or lameness, and some
of course
works coming out of this that you're most excited about in this part of the book?
Right on. So first of all, let me say that those terms are deceptively negative, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole way of reacting to hyperobjects, which is best summed up by the face of McCulkin, you know, in Home Alone, when he does that kind of horror face, like, oh my God, with his sort of hands on his cheeks, right? And there's this very negative strand of speculative realist philosophy that says horror and actually despair are the final, you know, reaction we should have, you know, to fully knowing what reality is, you know, or knowing more about what reality is. And I think that's like a big old trap of modernity. I agree with my friend Jeff Kripal, who's in the religion department at Rice. And he says there's a syndrome amongst modern intellectuals which goes something like this. If it's depressing, it must be true. Okay? So the words hypocrisy, weakness, and lameness are designed to provoke a kind of, you know, that kind of negative feeling, but then a kind of weird, ironic kind of comedy feeling. You know, it's so much easier to relate to people if you all admit that you're a hypocrite or a bit of a lame-o, or you haven't got all the answers, or you're a bit weak, right? And you're everyone's a little bit broken, right? It's so much easier, right? Why is it easier? Because I think that things are literally not just people, but, you know, spoons and jaguars and clouds and frogs are hypocritical, lame, and weak, right? And so I can talk about that a little bit, right? I think basically that the lameness comes from the fact that everything has, as a condition for its existing, a kind of inner flaw that Greek tragedy calls hamartia, which means wound, right? To exist at all, you have to have some kind of weird flaw, right, that could intrinsically destroy you. Think about the densest thing in the universe, a black hole, right? Even a black hole, which is bigger and badder than most things, eventually evaporates, right? Because it emits Hawking radiation. So it has this kind of inner inconsistency that causes it to collapse, right? As Gödel said about logical systems, in order for that system to be true on its own terms, it has to be able to speak nonsense. So funnily enough, it has to be able to say things that contradict what it's officially saying, right? So I take it that because logical systems are intrinsically flawed, therefore all beings are intrinsically flawed, which is the same as saying they're finite, right? Things are finite, right? The thing about hyperobjects is not that they're infinite, but they are distressingly finite. It's easy for us to imagine infinity. It's very difficult for us to imagine 100,000 years, which is how long global warming goes on for, right? And so that's the lameness, both of me thinking about global warming and of global warming itself, right? It contains an inner inconsistency, just like frogs or, you know, Greek tragic heroes, right? And the weakness has to do with the fact that, you know, whenever I encounter a thing, there's always this intrinsic gap between what it is and how it appears, so that my grasp of it is never completely total or perfect. So the way something else relates to something else is always a little bit weak in that sense, right? And I think that one of the things that we're learning, hopefully, from ecological awareness is that we are slightly lame and weak, and that it would be better if we weren't so much like, you know, kings of the earth, and more like sort of cunning, weedy people who try to kind of crawl around, not screwing anything up too much anymore, you know. And then the hypocrisy is also to do with that gap, right? It's the word hypocrisy comes from a Greek word that actually means actor, right? And I think that anything is a sort of actor, right? Like anything acts as a kind of delivery system for itself. And there's always this weird difference between what a thing is and how it appears, right? So there's, and that's what we call hypocrisy, right? You're different from how you appear, right? And I think also, you know, on a human level, that kind of defeats the idea that the top way of being right is cynicism. And here's why, which is my Clinton impersonation. I can't do an American accent. Don't ask me why. I've lived here for 22 years. I can't do it, but I can do it. Here's why, right? So basically, the cynical attitude is just disguised hypocrisy. If you think about it, being cynical means that you think that you have totally transcended all hypocrisy, right? So you have some kind of hope, actually. You also hope that if you vomit, you know, intellectually in public, disgustingly enough, other people might be convinced. You see, so you hope that your tactic will convince people. So you're actually a hypocrite because you're not totally cynical, right? So funnily enough, there's only two choices: straightforward hypocrisy or hypocritical hypocrisy, right? So I'm going with straightforward hypocrisy. And so I think that that's the position we're all in vis-a-vis acting ecologically, because when I do ecological action X, it means that I've excluded a little bit ecological action Y, right? I know that driving a Prius isn't going to save the planet, right? Lots of people go, oh, ha, 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 those stupid Prius drivers, whether they're from the right or the left or the environmental movement, they laugh at the poor Prius drivers, which I am one, right? And I know that, right? But it's better than a little bit not driving a Prius. It's especially better than cynically attaching wheels to a leaf blower and driving it around as a cynical statement about how you can never, ever, you know, fully, you know, destroy the oil industry through products that are about the oil industry, you know. And so there's a kind of lame hypocritical weakness to any ecological action, no matter what it is. It's always a little bit limited and finite, and so sort of getting used to that is kind of good. And it's a little bit like how for every three Greek tragedies in the Greek Tragedy Festival in Athens, there was a comedy, right? So it was like this, like, oh my God, I'm stuck in the web of fate. Oh my God, I'm stuck in the web of fate. Oh my God, I'm stuck in the web of fate. Actually, that's quite funny. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of like that, right? In the future, hopefully, there could be some kind of laughter that comes out of the sense of doom, rather than, despite the sense of doom, actually coming out of it, you know, in the same way that in the middle of John Carpenter's film The Thing morphs into this horrific sort of spider that's like an upside-down human head with these legs and sort of crawls out of the door. And one of the... Can I say an expletive on this, or shall I blank it out?
You can say an expletive.
All right. One of the guys, one of the scientists in the Antarctic says, "You gotta be fucking kidding," you know. And then they torture it, right? Mm-hmm. And it's this moment of horror, but it's also funny. It's really funny. It's like, it's so bad that you start laughing, and that's a little bit what ecological awareness is. It's so bad that you actually start laughing. It's not complete horror. The complete horror thing is that Home Alone phase that's sort of like stuck in this kind of gesture, you know, that doesn't go anywhere.
And it's not laughter as a kind of dismissiveness. It's laughter as a mm-hmm. mode of kind of deep engagement. And I think that's one of the right. things, as we, I've already taken up a whole bunch of your time, and so I'll bring us to a close at some point soon. But I wanted to just mention for listeners that one of the things that really comes out of the end of the book, despite or because of, as a product of this discussion of hypocrisy, weakness, lameness, is we're left with this flowering of beauty, this kind of creativity and beauty and the possibilities of being in the world that are manifest by music and by painting and by performance in ways that you're leaving us with that actually end the book on an extraordinarily inspiring note. And so listeners, go look at the paintings of Cornelia Hesse-Honegger. Listeners, go listen to the work, including the well-tuned piano. Lamont Young, is that how you pronounce his name?
Yes.
I'm going to mispronounce everything, but listen to Lamont Young's The Well-Tuned Piano. Listen to Francisco Lopez's sound art, including La Selva. Go find Jared Fowler's PS. Look at Kamara Tolliver's Pod. Look at Chris Wainwright's Red Ice 3. These are just a handful of the really beautiful objects that come out of the end of the book, where you're showing us the possibilities of where to go next. And I just want to thank you, because I would not have known of any of these before, and it's just completely opened my eyes.
Well, I see one of my jobs as introducing people to art that they might not know about, you know. And so it's been really fun over the years to have this conversation with slightly unknown or emerging artists. And some of these guys do work that's actually based on some of my stuff and or vice versa. And so I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to actually put these in the book, you know? And also just the fact that art, I truly believe, you know, and this is another conversation, but I think art is not just kind of candy on the surface of the dull cupcake of reality, right? And it is not also just PR for scientism. Art is actually directly working with cause and effect, right? In the same way that your Kulchi Napangati painting does something to you, right? It's directly working. Scientists study cause and effect. Artists make cause and effect, right? And so what they're doing, funnily enough, if you think about it, is they're channeling the future, right? Art is from the future. That sounds weird, doesn't it? But I truly think that art is like a way to see the future a little bit. It comes from the future. That's why it's not just a sort of representation of our cultural conditions. It's also a kind of gate into something that could like transcend those conditions.
It's creating a kind of temporality, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, Tim, I would love to talk to you truly for another couple of hours, and let's make time to talk to talk about this other whole set of issues that you just
brought up. Sure.
But for the time being, I need to let you go, because I've already taken up so much of your time, and thank you so much for your patience.
My pleasure. Now, really
despite the fact that we've talked for an hour or more than that, even before we came to this part of the conversation, there is a ton of material in the book and a ton of ideas that we didn't have a chance to talk about. It's extraordinarily rich, and we only just got to a bit of it. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book?
Oh my gosh. Well, okay. When you look at the picture on Amazon or whatever, you see this unbelievable picture of an iceberg. I wasn't responsible for that. I had an idea for the cover, but like all intellectuals don't really know jack about visual art, really, you know. And I thought my idea was good, but then they sent me this one and it was just beyond concept, you know. And they said that when they presented it to the, you know, editorial board, the design team, everybody gasped. And I think it's because the iceberg, it's like, is that 2 inches away and really small, or is it 2 miles away, or is it 20 miles away and really, really big, you know? And it's a composite photo, so it's a photo that a human could never see, because you see the iceberg above the water and you see the iceberg under the water, and that's perfectly hyperobject. It's like there's this real thing that you can't quite see, you know? And so the picture has this amazing, evocative, sort of delightful, slightly threatening horror slash wonder to it, you know. And even if you don't read the book, just look at that picture, because it really does, you know, it really does. It did something to me anyway when I saw it.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. So now that the book is out, and I'm still kind of, part of my brain is still processing the fact that you wrote this in 15 days. And so I know it's going to take me a little while to get over that. But now that the book is out, congratulations. What's next for you? Are there any projects right now that are currently inspiring you?
Oh, gosh.
I'm sure the answer is yes. But
yes,
that you'd like to mention?
Absolutely. I'm writing a book called Dark Ecology, which has taken a little bit of a time to get the mojo together for that, because that's a totally different form, but it's more burrowing into ecological awareness, you know, and this kind of loop form that I've been talking about. And I'm also writing a book called Weird Essentialism, because I am an essentialist, but I'm a weird essentialist. I figured that out. Like the early 70s French feminists, you know, they were essentialists, but they weren't your grandma's essentialism, you know. And so I think there really are things like spoons, you know, but they're weird spoons, right? And so I'm writing that. And I'm just about to publish this thing on Buddhism. It's like a study of Buddhism by me and these two other guys in this Chicago series called Trios. And that's another thing I'm very interested in. And finally, I figured out that it could best be like a really, really long essay with these other two essays that were like in dialogue with it, or trialogue, or whatever you call that.
Wow. Have you ever, just the last thing that I'll ask you, just because it just occurred to me after some of the things that you were saying.
Yeah.
Have you ever curated an exhibit at a museum?
Do you know what? I've talked about possible exhibits about hyperobjects. I'm about to go to the South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin to talk about an exhibit that was done by someone else based on his idea of my idea of dark ecology. And it, apparently it's this building covered with styrofoam with mushrooms growing out of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm going to talk about that for some bizarre reason. They wanted me to say something about it. And then I'm actually thinking that with this dark ecology project, like there's a lot of visual art and hyper objects. And in this dark ecology one, I would like there to be a companion CD or album on iTunes or website or something where there was music, because for some reason there's a lot of music in that concept. And so I'd like to, you know, curate some kind of sound art event that was around that, actually, very much indeed. And I'm talking to all these musicians who are doing things on dark ecology a little bit already, seeing if I can get them together to sort of make something out of that, you know.
I think that's totally brilliant, and I'm going to look forward to that. I'm going to look forward to that.
Oh gosh, me too. Yeah.
Vincent, thank you so much again for your generosity and your good humor in dealing with the technology. It's just an absolutely inspiring and brilliant book, and it was such
a pleasure. I'm so touched by that. That's very, very nice of you, and thank you for being such a great interviewer and for helping me to, you know, give words to some of these things that are quite difficult even for me to sort of put into words, you know.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.